Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. John Canzano.
People don't like to hear the truth all the time. You know, people ask you questions, but they don't actually necessarily want to hear the answers.
Love him.
I mean, I like the guy. I listen to him every day.
Canzano, what's going on, man?
He's dead sexy.
I think he does a damn good job.
I'm going to be rooting for this young Portland team, which, you know, is a terrific team. You guys just have a terrific nucleus.
You pay attention to detail. That's why you're so successful.
I just think he's honest. Straightforward and to the point.
You're bringing up something that's probably the average sports fan watching the game didn't pick up on.
I'm really glad to see that someone who speaks their mind is not afraid to tell it how it is.
He's a smart guy. That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Hate him.
You don't want to get nobody a second chance. Trump.
To represent that as some sort of subterfuge by John Canzano, I would have expected far better.
He just sounds like an egotistical idiot.
He was rude, crude, and wrong.
Love to hate him.
Yo, John, I can't stand you. I can't stand you, but I come back every day to listen to the show.
Bald-faced truth teller.
Who is he to judge?
Well, he can raise your eyebrows a lot.
I was angry. He just got my feathers that day big time.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth.
This portion of the Bald-Faced Truth is brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights. Need a machinery job done right? Call High Caliber today.
A lot of speculation about Chip Kelly to Florida. I want to talk about that today. Because immediately when you hear Chip Kelly to Florida or Chip Kelly to Tennessee, I don't know what you think about. But I think about the Oregon Ducks. I think about timing. I think Willie Taggart is going to end up being the right hire, but when Chip Kelly's father died late last year, remember, the Ducks were looking for a football coach, and a contingent of the high-ranking Ducks officials stopped the search and flew to the funeral in Maine. Now, the Ducks had not yet offered Willie Taggart the position, and the search, as you know, had been headquartered in Dallas and then moved to New York. The search committee was involved at that point. But when it came time to pay respects to Paul Kelly, Chip's dad, the Oregon Brain Trust diverted to that funeral. And of course, there was speculation like, would Chip Kelly be coming back to Oregon? Were they going there on business or were they going there to pay respects? Of course they were going to pay respects, but were they also going to talk to Chip Kelly about this job? And I thought about that today as you heard rumors with the Florida Gators, a lot of websites reporting a lot of nonsense and people saying this is a done deal. And but it made me think about Oregon and it made me think about timing because, you know, if you think about Chip Kelly, timing is everything with Chip Kelly. The Ducks were without a football coach in early December 2016. Chip Kelly had gone 46-7 at Oregon, but now he was with the 49ers and he was 1-11 and on his way to being fired. And he was telling the media, I'm committed to winning games. I'm committed to staying in the NFL. But in the days after that funeral, Taggart was hired. And it got me thinking, I wondered amid all that, did Oregon ever ask Chip Kelly, do you want to come back to Eugene? Before it moved to Taggart. And the answer came to me from somebody who was involved and was at that funeral. They said, no, they did not talk to Chip Kelly directly at the funeral about the job. And here's the quote. Quote, it's kind of like seducing an old girlfriend. Good idea, but hard to find the right words. End quote. Timing's everything. For Kelly in particular, Mike Bellotti hires him from New Hampshire. After he had misfired on Gary Croton and Andy Ludwig at the offensive coordinator position, people don't know, or maybe you do know, but the New York Giants, Tom Coughlin, had tried to hire Chip Kelly from New Hampshire as well as a quality control guy in the NFL, low-level job. But Chip Kelly took the Oregon job. And it ended up being a great move. It ended up being the greatest recruitment of Mike Bellotti's career. Chip Kelly comes to Oregon. The Ducks go from decent to dynamic. The Oregon football office took, when Chip Kelly rose to be the head coach, the Oregon football office became a different place. They were doing things differently. Practice times changed. The sleep cycle of players changed. Recruiting process changed. Suddenly, there were scouting services available, and people went, wait a minute, this is a little different feel. Oregon's really trying some things here. And everybody looks at that NCAA investigation into Oregon, as you rightfully should, and go, okay, should they have been involved with scouting services? Should Willie Lyles have been somebody that Oregon was on a first-name basis with? Chip Kelly, told me once he didn't know who Willie Lyles was, and then he was like, oh, Will. Not Willie. Oh, Will, you meant Will. I was like, yeah, Will Lyles. But Oregon ultimately got slapped with the NCAA probation, didn't have bowl sanctions. There was a loss. There were some recruiting penalties that came with it. Chip Kelly got an 18-month show cause penalty. So there was some of that going on. And, you know, looking back at it in hindsight, I think we all can acknowledge that Chip Kelly and what he was trying to do at Oregon was he was just pushing the envelope. He was looking for angles. He was looking for a way to win. He was like, all right, these are the rules. This is how we're going to do it. It's the same stuff he did on offense. Like, you know, why do we have to wait for the defense to line up? Let's just snap the ball. Why are we giving away that advantage? So it was always little things with Kelly in college, right? He did all these little things right and helped him win. In the NFL, it was the same stuff that cost him his job. See, in the NFL, you try to play GM and you try to out-scheme guys, you get beat. In college football, you play GM, you're just recruiting. And you've got an inherent advantage because once you get these kids on campus, you're not going to get a DeMarco Murray or a LaShawn McCoy situation where a guy goes, I don't want to play for that guy anymore. So in the college, in the NFL, what got Chip Kelly was Chip Kelly. He belongs in college. It's the right place for Chip Kelly, college, where he can scheme and try to find inherent advantages and recruit, and where you have more control over the players and the players aren't going to hell with you. You can't tell me when to sleep. So I've always believed that if he could get back to college where he could utilize recruiting, look out, because he's got something to prove. I think he'd win at Florida. I think he'd win at Tennessee. I think he'd win if he came back to Oregon. I think he'd win if he was at UCLA. But the question with Chip Kelly is, where does he belong? Where's the right place for him? And where, if you're a Duck fan, is a place you can live with it? Do you want him in the SEC? Do you want to see him against Nick Saban in Alabama? Could he tip that conference on its head? Could he cause big problems if he went to Tennessee or to Florida? Do you want him back in the Pac-12 if you're a Duck fan coaching against you? I think it would be really hard for Chip Kelly to come home. And by home, I mean Eugene. It's not really home. I'm just talking in a figurative sense that it's a place where he's been. But I think going back to somewhere where you're 46-7 is kind of a lick your wounds acknowledgement that, man, it didn't work out. Maybe it's this place and not me. And that's not Chip Kelly, is it? Not his style. I can't imagine the guy quitting anything he'd ever started. I also believe that if he gets back to college football, I think it's not because of money. He's got $55 million in earnings and two NFL jobs that he got fired from. I think it's about Chip Kelly proving that Chip Kelly can do this again. It's about Chip Kelly, who lost to an SEC team in a BCS championship game in 2011, Cam Newton and Auburn. Ugh, what a game. What a finish. What a bitter finish to Chip Kelly's college coaching championship aspirations. He said it was unfinished. He came back, and then ultimately by 2013, if he had just stuck it out, could Oregon have got back there, or did he kind of do what he could do at Oregon? I want you to assess that for me. When you think about Chip Kelly and what he accomplished at Oregon, I mean, he made Jerry Allen cry on that broadcast. The Ducks are going to the BCS championship game. And Jerry Allen was near tears. Has that ship sailed? Can Oregon ever get back there? Can Oregon ever make that happen again? You tell me, 503-417-7575. And is Chip Kelly the key? Where does he belong if you're a Duck fan? If a Beaver fan out there is listening to this, they're looking for a coach. Nobody's talking about Chip Kelly to Corvallis because Chip Kelly knows the challenges in Corvallis. And frankly, he can do 10 times better, 100 times better with a coaching job. So nobody's talking about that. But if you're an Oregon State fan, do you want this guy in your conference? Do you think he's just a coach who was the right time, right place guy? Or do you think if you instill Chip Kelly at Florida or Georgia or UCLA, suddenly Chip Kelly wins big? 503-417-7575. You tell me what happens with Chip Kelly, and does he go to the, you know, does he end up in a national championship situation? Is that the finish that you're looking for? If you're an Oregon Ducks fan, is there unfinished business? Does he end up back in Oregon someday? Or is that just too big of a leap?
Can you believe the magical season this has become, and it's not over? And somewhere down in that humanity, a soaking wet Chip Kelly is talking to the media about his team and what they have accomplished. Unbelievable to have been a part of this.
I want you to weigh in on that, whether you're listening to this show in Fox Sports Eugene, or you're listening in Klamath Falls, or you're listening somewhere in between Portland and there on 102.9 FM, 750 The Game. You tell me at 503-417-7575, where does Chip Kelly belong in football? Was it just a perfect storm? Because the argument can be made that the conference was weak, USC and Washington were down, there was a unique style that is no longer unique that gave him a competitive edge, and that he was a smart guy. 503-417-7575. You tell me where Chip Kelly belongs in football, and you tell me, is he successful? Or does he come into major college football again at Florida or Tennessee or UCLA or wherever there's an opening? Does he come in and struggle the way he did in the NFL? I know Bill Belichick was really disappointed when Chip Kelly got fired in Philadelphia because Kelly had beat the Patriots while an Eagles coach. He had had more wins in his first three seasons in Philadelphia than 15 coaches that who were in the Hall of Fame had in their first three seasons. He was kind of on his way when he had problems with the locker room, and he had problems with his own front office, and he had ultimately problems with ownership. Does Chip Kelly's return end up a success? And would you bank on Oregon ever being in the conversation again for Chip Kelly? I know if you're a Duck fan, you take him back in a heartbeat. It's like that ex-girlfriend. It's seducing an ex-girlfriend. It's a good idea, but can you find the words if you're the Ducks? 503-417-7575. And I don't mean any disrespect to Willie Taggart, because Willie Taggart has this job, and I think he would understand better than anybody, somebody who has had success on a big-time level. You look back and you go, this was the most successful period of Oregon football, bar none, not close. You tell me, plus coming up, we'll go to Nebraska where Tom Chattel says, enough of Mike Riley. And we'll go to San Jose where John Wilner of the Mercury News says, the Pac-12 can be fixed. What does he mean by that? You hear it on today's show. Nick Aliotti was Chip Kelly's defensive coordinator at Oregon. What is he saying about Chip Kelly getting back into coaching?
I always have seen Chip as a guy that still wants to coach football. I think he's enjoying what he's doing with ESPN, but I would think that if the right job came up, absolutely Chip would be back into coaching.
There you go. I think he's right. I don't think it's about money. I think the guy wants to win. I think he likes the adrenaline rush of playing chess against another coach. I think he's more interested, obviously, in the offensive side of the ball than the defensive side of the ball. And I think if you're an Oregon fan, I kind of feel like Chip Kelly's done what he can do at Oregon. And I felt that not just in the first time that Chip Kelly left Oregon for the Buccaneers. Remember that? Overnight, he chip-flopped. He went over. Oh, I'm taking the job. No, I'm not. Just killed me. I was on Deadline writing a column. I wrote a column saying Chip's gone to the Buccaneers. Like an hour later, get a message that was sent from Chip going, he's changed his mind. Hang on. Don't publish that. And then you write a column going, well, there's unfinished business. There's more for him to come back. A lot of people nationally interested in what Chip Kelly does. You tell me if he'd be successful. Do you think it works? Let's just use Florida as an example. And ultimately, if Florida doesn't want to talk to Chip Kelly, they're nuts. Scott Frost, Chip Kelly, there are some people there, Mike Leach even. Mike Leach loves Florida. Loves the state, has a place in Key West. I mean, Gainesville's not Key West, but hell of a lot closer than Pullman. If you're Florida, that's a good job with good upside. Great conference. You're sitting in a hotbed of talent. You don't have to recruit very far to get the kind of players you need to win. And by the way, did Chip Kelly ever need players in college to really win? He had good players. He didn't need great ones. When he was at Oregon and he took Oregon to the national championship game against Auburn, a game they probably should have won, the Ducks had no players drafted in the first round in that next NFL draft. None. It's remarkable what he did scheming against coaches. But has he lost that advantage? If you're playing devil's advocate with this one, you say that it was military-like and that Chip Kelly acted with a strategic advantage. He took advantage of rules and was able to snap the ball before the defense was ready. He took advantage of rules in college and was able to use scouting services when the NCAA was going, what's a scouting service? He pushed the envelope in every way. Has college football changed to the point where Chip Kelly is on a level playing field? Pat Forty of Yahoo Sports, I talked to him about Chip Kelly in the late summer. We talked about the NFL versus college. Here's what Pat Forty said.
I think he'll go back to college. I do. You know, I saw him at Spencer. I saw him at the Final Four and had a pretty long chat with him. And he seems, you know, just very relaxed and kind of perfectly fine with the situation of being out of football. Now, it's April at that time. We'll see what it's like in August and September.
And now he's sat out. You tell me what happens with Chip Kelly and whether or not it's successful. I think it would work. And I think it's unfinished. And by the way, the column I posted on Oregon Live today about Chip Kelly and a possible return to college football, there's a quote in there from a high-ranking Ducks athletic department official who said that Chip Kelly is an Olympian when it comes to being stubborn. Isn't that a trait where, like, I talk to my kids all the time. I've got three daughters. And I talk to them all the time, and I'm really careful with what I say to them as a dad. And I've read all these books, right, on what raising confident daughters and what dads are supposed to say and paid attention to dads. And I've done a lot of looking around, and I see dads who have raised girls that are like strong, confident girls. I talk to them, and I say, well, what did you tell them? What was important? What messaging did you give them? And one of the things I talk with about the girls, even the three-year-old, is I'm really careful to not just say she's, like, when she looks cute, like, hey, you're cute or you're pretty. I'm careful to do that. Like, I might think it. I'm going, oh, my gosh, she's so cute. Like, this morning, she had a ponytail. And she's like, it's like an elephant trunk. And I was like, that's the cutest thing ever. But I didn't want to say it. Instead, I go, you know what? You're strong. You're smart. You're also cute. I try to make that, like, the third thing. And it's interesting to me when we talk about, you know, the confidence that you have in kids and building confidence in kids, that you have the ability as a parent to steer kids in the right direction, just with little things. Because I even think to this point, even the three-year-old, she understands the difference between, you know, a princess in the Disney world. And she's probably getting that from all the media that she sees and all the shows that she watches. And she understands like some of the stereotypes, even with the princesses in the Disney world. And I'm like, well, where you already have that at three. There's just so much, I think, when you talk about raising confident kids in that whole world. That could be a whole show that we do unto itself. I'd be remiss today if I didn't mention something else in the news. You'll probably see it. I don't know if you'll understand it, but Bobby Doerr was the oldest living baseball Hall of Famer. He was 99 years old, 99 and 5 months. He passed away yesterday in Junction City, Oregon. Former Red Sox great. I got a little audio of him. He's talking about his major league debut. He debuted, by the way, in 1937. I don't know what you were doing in 1937, but I'm guessing you weren't hitting in the Boston Red Sox lineup.
I kind of thought maybe I got in over my head a little bit. I especially we opened the season in Philadelphia, and I did pretty well down there. And then we went to Yankee Stadium where I faced Gomez and Monty Pearson and Bump Hadley. Tough pitchers. Hadley and Pearson were just good curveball pitchers, and of course Gomez, good stuff. And playing in Yankee Stadium for the first time, I'd never seen any ballpark like that before. And after seeing the stuff I saw there, I just kind of wondered if I was in over my head a little bit. And I think I could have done better if I would have had a little better feeling about the whole thing.
Yeah, he went on to make the Hall of Fame. 9-time All-Star. Red Sox teammates said that he was a guy that when they hit him a ground ball, they knew it was an out. He had the American League record at one point for most consecutive chances at second base without an error. He handled 414 consecutive ground balls without making an error. He hit 288 in his career, more than 2,000 hits, more than 200 home runs. And by the way, the 223 home runs at the time of his retirement was the third highest total ever by a second baseman. He also missed the 1945 season to serve in the military. And, you know, he came back in 46 to help lead the Red Sox to the pennant. And by the way, in the World Series in 46, he hit 409. Died yesterday at the age of 99. 99 years old and 5 months. He was the oldest living baseball Hall of Famer and the oldest living major leaguer. The oldest living player to have played in the major leagues as of yesterday. Bobby Doerr, I would just want to send thoughts to his family. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention him. I noticed that today I was kind of walking around today and was like, do you know who Bobby Doerr is? And some people who had had interactions in Junction City with him said that he was at a lot of community events and he was around a little bit. And other people were like, who? And I think that's something that happens. Like Ted Williams called this guy. They called him the silent captain. They never had a captain, the Red Sox, but the silent captain. And, you know, here was a guy that played at a high level, was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, and lived for most of his life since like 1930 in the state of Oregon. And nobody knew it. Like, you know, maybe you knew it if you lived near Junction City or saw him, but so a lot of people now, young people now, are like, who's Bobby Doerr? Learn your history, damn it. You know, pay attention. You got to know these things. And we have connection here in the Portland area with players like Johnny Pesky, and because of the old PCL Pacific Coast League games, that there was a lot of connection with the PCL players and that era of baseball in the city of Portland. I hear people waxing nostalgic about it, but I think we're losing more and more of that as the players that were PCL players, of course, age out and pass away. Important to keep hold of our history. All right, make sure you're following me on Twitter at John Canzano BFT. Coming up, Tom Chattel of the Omaha World Herald. He's coming up in a few minutes. Andrew Greif, who covers the Ducks for the Oregonian, will be joining us top of the hour. And then at 2:00, a really interesting conversation with John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News. Wilner has been a burr in the saddle of the Pac-12 conference. He has been all over Conference Commissioner Larry Scott. And before you can even say get him on the show, we have attempted to get Larry Scott, the Pac-12 commissioner, on the show.
Get him on the show.
And he apparently is busy. He says his people. He's got people. His people say he's busy. I'll bet he's busy. You know, on Friday night, the Washington-Stanford debacle on Fox Sports 1 was an absolute joke. People are watching pickup truck racing when they should have been watching these two great teams in the conference play each other. And for 45 minutes, everybody was like, I didn't even know they had pickup truck racing. But we've asked for Larry Scott. They're telling us he's kind of busy in the next couple of weeks. We can revisit, which is code for he just doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to be quoted on it. He doesn't have a good answer. And that's troubling to me because if you're the Pac-12, all you have to do is trot Larry Scott out right now and have Larry Scott empathize with the viewers who are frustrated. We know it's about money, Larry. We know it. We get it. Can you just say it's about money? And hey, you know, in the next deal, in the next round of negotiations, I will really try to do a better job of making sure we put fans first. That's all people want to hear. Pickup truck racing. That's what I'm talking about. I want you to leave it here. Coming up, Tom Chattel, plus your phone calls at 503-417-7575. This PK-80 basketball tournament is potentially problematic. I'm really curious, as are some of my friends I've been emailing with, about whether or not anybody's going to show up to this thing. We're talking about Thanksgiving Day games, day after Thanksgiving games, great basketball, but here's the bottom line. There are still a ton of good seats available for this event. And for people who don't know, this is the basketball tournament that is being held to honor Phil Knight. We're talking about Thanksgiving Day, day after Thanksgiving. Civil War football game got moved to accommodate this thing to a Saturday, which is where college football should be anyway. But the ESPN TV deal, which means you're going to be able to watch these games, is that why you're not buying tickets? Is it the late session on Thanksgiving Day that has a 7 p.m. and a 9 p.m. game on Thanksgiving Day? Is it Black Friday? Are you a Black Friday person? Gliss, are you a Black Friday person? You go out, do you get up at 3 a.m., you stand in line over there at the Best Buy?
No. When I was in high school, I would like go with my mom when she would go to the mall and get, you know, my brother's Furbies and stuff. I thought it was cool then to like get up early and go to the mall, but no, I don't do that anymore.
Droz, are you a Black Friday shopper?
No, but I go just to kind of see the crazy stuff going on.
You do go? Are you like lined up outside the store, or what do? Are you face pressed against the window over there at the store?
I did it a couple of years ago just so I could kind of go see everybody and just see the crazy. But other than that, I didn't buy anything. I didn't have money.
Yeah, so you get up on Black Friday at some ungodly hour, or did you just not go to bed?
Well, back in Colorado, Black Friday shopping starts at like 10 o'clock Thursday night. So you get the advantage of not having to go to bed yet.
People will get in line to get like the newest toy, but they won't go to see a basketball game. This PK-80 thing, the tickets aren't selling. Why do you think the tickets aren't selling?
I mean, it's a bad weekend. Why would they, you know, like you said, it's the weekend of Thanksgiving. A lot of people are traveling, coming in and out of town. It just seems like a really bad time to hold a tournament. And it's a shame because, I mean, it's a pretty unique situation early in college basketball where there's like some of the best programs in the country are going to be here.
Here's a great example, okay? Because we're having Thanksgiving at my house this year, and we're going to invite relatives over, and of course, everybody wants to know what time. So I had to last night look at the PK-80 bracket to determine what time Thanksgiving dinner is going to happen at our house. And I don't know if you're a person who eats Thanksgiving dinner at like 2 p.m. or at 7 p.m. because families move it around. It's kind of a Christmas Day, Christmas Eve present thing where, you know, traditionally in our family growing up, we had like a mid-afternoon Thanksgiving dinner. And it came complete with watching the football games and then family being around. And some of that was due to the fact that it was always held at my grandparents' house, and so we were commuting, and so the Thanksgiving dinner would probably be like a 2 p.m. or a 3 p.m. or a 4 p.m. thing. It was never 6, 7, 8. It was never dark when we were eating the turkey, okay? And do you do that at your house? What time do you do the bird? What time
kind of like, you know, mid to late afternoon, somewhere in there.
In college, I dated a girl whose parents ate like, they were like, Thanksgiving, it's dinner. And they ate it like a real dinner. And I was like, that's way too late.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's more like, it's a whole day. So I kind of figured, you know, you want to stretch it out a little bit.
It was like Larry Scott was one of their family members. And he just pushed Thanksgiving dinner to a 7:30 start. You know, it was just like, it didn't work for me. But here are the games. Thanksgiving, game number one on Thanksgiving is University of Portland plays North Carolina. This is an opportunity to see North Carolina. Problem is, it's an 11:30 a.m. tip. Game's on ESPN, so you can watch it anyway. So why are you going to buy a ticket and go sit at Moda Center when you can be in your living room preparing that bird? It's a problem for me because I'm like, if the turkey's on the Traeger, I got to be in charge of that. You know?
Yeah, I'm really curious to see, especially on Thanksgiving, how many, I mean, that seems like very problematic that they're going to be able to sell tickets for that.
Arkansas-Oklahoma is the second game of Session 1. That is a 2 p.m. start. So you get North Carolina, Portland, Arkansas, Oklahoma. Then comes the 6 p.m. game, UConn and Oregon. Okay? So what am I supposed to do with that? Leave Thanksgiving dinner early? Be like, I got to go. Like, even for me, whose job it is to cover these games, I'm looking at it going, did somebody not think about Thanksgiving here? And I don't think they did. I think they thought about the television audience, and I think they thought about the ESPN affiliation. Michigan State and DePaul in the nightcap, 8:30. So have fun with that. And then here comes Black Friday. So you get the winners of probably North Carolina beats Portland and Arkansas-Oklahoma winner. I'm going to take Oklahoma. So you get Oklahoma and North Carolina at 12:30 on Black Friday. Okay, and then you get Oregon beats UConn, and you get Michigan State over DePaul. So you get Oregon and Michigan State in a game that is scheduled right now for either 6:30 or 9 p.m. They don't know. There you go.
See, I would do the Friday games. I'd rather be at a basketball game than be at Black Friday.
And we will be broadcasting right smack in the middle of that North Carolina-Oklahoma, you know, semifinal game. But it's setting up to put North Carolina and Oregon in the final, which would be Sunday, November 26th, because Saturday's the Civil War. So a day off between. I want to know, are you going to go see these games? And do you eat your Thanksgiving dinner? At what time do you do it? And by the way, we all think we have eccentric things. Like, what's the one thing at Thanksgiving dinner that you look forward to? What's the biggest draw for you personally about a Thanksgiving dinner? Because to me, my grandfather, who was in his 90s, and he comes up over and over when I talk about nostalgia and things like this, he used to have a highball. Like, he'd be watching the football game, he'd be drinking a little whiskey and, you know, 7-Up or something, and he might even have me mixing it at like 12 or 13 years old. Hey, go get me a highball. And I'd bring it back, and he'd swirl it around, and he'd go, oh, that's a good one. And to this day, when I take that first drink on Thanksgiving Day or Christmas Day or whatever, I always go, that's a good one. Because it's him. So to me, it was more of the sitting around and the run-up to the game. It was kind of like the Super Bowl. It's like the game itself is not, the turkey itself is really not Thanksgiving to me. It's the run-up, it's the hoopla around it. What is it for you guys in your households? What's the thing you look forward to?
Same thing, football and a little bit of day drinking with the family, and yeah.
Day drinking. Do you know what the millennials call it? They call it a day fade.
Yeah.
No?
No.
Am I wrong? Sorry.
Adriana says no.
She says no, they don't. She immediately shook her head. Like, nope, you're wrong. What do the millennials call drinking during the day? What do you guys call that?
We call it day drinking.
No, you call it a day fade. It's a day fade. Can I get somebody cooler on? It's not day drinking. It's day drinking during the day. We did that anyway. We just didn't have a name for it.
I never knew I was so cool by saying that.
Day drinking. Gliss, you are a resident millennial. All right, so tell me if you're going to go to these events and tell me what your Thanksgiving thing is. 503-417-7575. I want to hear from you. My thing, it always comes back to my grandfather, and people ask me that. My wife even says that. She says he was such an influential person in your world. And he was, because he was such a good storyteller, and he was kind of the master of ceremonies at the dinner table. And he was the one directing. He was the, you know, directing the three-ring circus that was Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner or whatever. And my grandmother was cooking, and there was football on in the background, and the Detroit Lions were getting their brains beat in, and nothing says Thanksgiving like the Lions getting their brains beat in. And then the NFL decides that, you know what, we're going to monkey around with the NFL games on Thanksgiving. And I don't know if you know the Thanksgiving lineup. Do you know what's going on with Thanksgiving?
For this year?
Yeah.
I assume the Cowboys and the Lions play at some point, right?
Vikings, Lions. Thanksgiving. It's the morning game. And the afternoon game is the Giants and the Redskins. That's it. Chargers-Cowboys is the middle game. So the Cowboys play, but they play the Chargers. And that's it. And you get your Sunday games. So sorry to say, if you're looking forward to the Lions and the Cowboys, I always thought the Packers were playing the Lions. That's the game that I always wanted to see. And you talk about schedule makers. Like, they can't get the Thursday night thing right, but they can get Thanksgiving. It, you know, they could always get the Lions on Thanksgiving. How is that possible? Leave it right here. We're going to go to Nebraska next. Mike Riley's in trouble, and Tom Chattel of the Omaha World Herald says he's, in fact, finished. Trouble in Lincoln, Nebraska. Tom Chattel, Omaha World Herald, does a fantastic job writing columns there, and he has been all over this Mike Riley thing. Chattel, is Riley done?
Stick a fork in him, baby. That's the old cliche, right?
Is it hard?
Yeah. It's over. Yeah, and it's sad in some ways, but you know what? The fans here really didn't get to know him well enough to be, you know, really sad. So they want to win, and they don't want to. They just had the worst loss maybe they've had in since the early '60s on Saturday. They got walked over by Minnesota Gopher. So not good.
The players appeared to quit on him. Did you see that from the press box?
Yes, and I hesitated to write it because that's one of the most damning things you could say about any athlete is to say that they quit.
Yeah.
Unless you're in their head or in their heart, you just don't know. You know, maybe they're dealing with something, but all these guys couldn't be dealing with something. So it did not look good. I asked Mike after the game about it twice. He talked around it. It's hard for a head coach to even go there also. So, but yeah, I mean, if you watch the game, I thought it was obvious.
The program has to be rubbernecking a little bit, looking over at Florida and Scott Frost and thinking, okay, who's next? How difficult is it for Riley to do his job while that's going on?
He says, and I've asked him this several times along the way, he says not at all. He focuses, he says, I'm a big boy. I've been around the block a few times. I know how this goes. Although I'm not sure how many times at Oregon State he was really this close to getting fired.
Never. Never.
Yeah. So, you know, it happened to San Diego, obviously, a long time ago. But, yeah, John, it's these guys say no big deal, but it's a big deal. They got families. You know, they came here, it was a Hail Mary hire, and it was a Hail Mary on their part. It was a leap of faith. Could this work? And they all came out with him, and it's not working out, and it's too bad. You know, you wonder where some of these guys are going to end up, and it's too bad that they really had a good thing going in Oregon State. Now, maybe there's some Beavers that don't agree, but you know, for a while there, they really did have it going in some ways. So, but like anything in college or any sports, a coach can stay too long at a place, and then people get tired of you. That isn't the case here. He didn't stay that long. But I'm saying maybe at Oregon State, you know, it was time. And so, but, yeah, you wonder – you know, they're all good guys. You know, the good guys like Mike Kavanaugh, Trent Bray. I think Trent will find a job. He's a good young coach. He can recruit. It's just as hard. You know, a lot of these guys are, it's part of the deal.
Talking to Tom Chattel, columnist, Omaha World Herald. Do you think Riley has another job in him, or is this it for him and this is how he goes out?
Well, everything is interesting. We freshman that he never bought in Lincoln. He and wife D had the running out of condo instead with Lincoln the whole time. He's, you know, and that's fine. People got worked up about them not being owning a house, but when you're empty nesters, you don't need a big house, right? So, you know, having a condo's on the golf course is pretty cool. So, but everything I've heard, I never asked them this, but they still have a house at Corvallis.
Yes.
So my impression is you go back there because that's where you grew up and that's where you still have a lifelong family friends. But they also have this this cool little spread down in Central Texas, in the Hill Country, where they listen to good music and hang out in the summer. So that's not a bad fallback either. And certainly he's going to get his money. So does he coach again? I don't think he does. Maybe he could be a consultant going anywhere. I don't know if he becomes a head coach. Maybe there's a small college that would, maybe back in Oregon somewhere. He'd be a great hire for them. But Power Five, head coach, I don't think so.
Tom, the Nebraska speculation obviously goes to Scott Frost. Any shot Mike Leach is a candidate given Bill Moose there as the AD?
No, Leach was – we're very familiar with him from the old Big 12. He's a niche hire. He's sort of a – he's sort of an acquired taste. Sports writers love him, but for AD, he's definitely an acquired taste in a fan base. And he doesn't really win big, right? If you look at his resume, he gets it going once in a while, but generally you're going to get 8-4 in that ballpark, and he's going to throw it a lot, and he's going to be very quotable, and he can be cantankerous, and he's an old fashioned character. You're going to love him, but. That doesn't work in a football, a school like this where the expectations are so high. Now, I think even Moose understands that he was the right guy at Pullman because he has a style, he has a system, it works. If you get a quarterback, and they've had over the years, Washington State's had Jack Thompson and Drew Bledsoe and so on and so forth. So they've been able to get a handful of guys, to show up there. So I think it works there. It doesn't work here. It especially doesn't work in the Big Ten West. But this Oregon State system has failed in the Big Ten West. Interestingly, if they land Frost, he runs a spread, but it's a very physical spread. And that's what you need here. Before you worry about scheme, you have to worry about bloody noses. There has to be violence. And they got pushed around so bad by Minnesota last week, just so bad. It was embarrassing for everybody. But you've got to be able to stop the run here, and if you want to run spread and stuff, it's great because you can run out of the spread. But you've got to be physical. You got to have that sort of attack mentality. And so he's never had it here. And it just, obviously that system worked at Oregon State for years. They've got quarterbacks and they won, 9-10 games a few times. I mean, it's just out in this league, if you can't run it or stop the run, it's not going to work.
Tom Chattel, Omaha World Herald. Before I cut you loose, if it's not Scott Frost, who is it? Is someone like Chip Kelly interested? And I guess maybe the question is Nebraska still a prime job given where it is, given the landscape in college football? Or do you look around and go, hey, some things have changed around us here?
It has, but you're in the big. You have to look at it like this. You're in the Big Ten West, which is not stellar. It's not a grinder. I mean, it's a grinder in that you've got to show up
and they're going to hit you every week, and they've got solid coaches and solid programs, but they're not overly talented. The NFL draft is not coming through the Big Ten West necessarily a lot. So, if you can be the guy to recruit, but also play the kind of ball that Wisconsin and Iowa play, which isn't rocket science, it's just good solid football. Sure, you can win this division. You don't have to win it every year, but you can get your share. And then all you got to do. I mean, Iowa showed us how to beat Ohio State, right? And they also almost beat Penn State. So you can go to Indianapolis and take your shot. And then, you know, a few years ago, Iowa almost got in the playoff. And they beat Michigan State during the playoff. And this year, Wisconsin's sitting there about as vanilla as you can be. They are vanilla on top of vanilla. And they got a shot to be in the playoffs. So it can be done. They have more money than anybody knows. They're starting to get, if we just had a story this year, their Big Ten take now is going to be $51 million a year, and that's going to go up. So there's plenty of money, which is good because they're paying off like 10 coaches.
Yeah.
But they're going to be paying off another one here. But they have money. Who would it be if not Frost? I don't know. I do trust Moose to have a pretty good plan and a pretty good feel for it.
Right, Tom, I got to get going, but we love having you on, man. I really appreciate you.
Have fun. We'll see you at Portland down the road.
All right. We'll see you there. Tom Chattel. Leave it right here. Andrew Greif talks Ducks next.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The Bald-Faced Truth.
John Canzano.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great.
He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, from the Pac West Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth.
This portion of the Bald-Faced Truth is brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights. Need a machinery job done right? Call High Caliber today.
So I've been poking around this Chip Kelly thing, thinking like, okay, is he coming back? Is he not coming back? So I reached out to a friend of Chip Kelly's, somebody who's in touch with Chip Kelly on a regular basis. And I said, what's the deal with Chip Kelly? What do you know? And he said, nothing specific. He said, Chip's bored, and he'll go back to work next season if the right opportunity opens. That's interesting. Which brings us, of course, to our Oregon Ducks segment with our insider, Andrew Greif.
You want experts? We have them. The writers who know what's what. The people in the know. The A-Team on the Beavers and Ducks.
Touchdown, Beavers!
Touchdown, Freeman!
Brought to you by Carlitas.
Andrew Greif, our insider, covers the Oregon Ducks. Timing is everything, we know that. If the Oregon Ducks had an opening, would Chip Kelly have been candidate number one if this had lined up?
For last year or this year?
Last year. If no Willie Taggart and Chip's available, I mean, is that not the guy they're just talking to?
Well, I think that he'd obviously be someone they want to talk to and gauge his interest. I mean, shoot, Mark Helfrich called him. He said that when he got fired a couple days later, he went on ESPN Radio and said that he himself had made kind of a plea to Chip, say, hey, if you come back and I am not brought back, at least you could keep the staff together. So it makes sense that he would be a guy that probably the first call on Rob Mullen's list would say, hey, would you be interested?
I also wonder, you know, because there's two theories. One is that Chip Kelly was successful because the Pac-12 was down, USC and Washington were down, and he was doing something nobody else was doing, and he was taking advantage of snapping the ball early, and the defense wasn't ready, and those things have all changed. Do you think he would have adapted? Would he be successful now? Will he win again if he comes back to college football?
Well, I think both those things are true about why he succeeded at Oregon. And I wasn't covering him at the time, but it was just pretty obvious just seeing how revolutionary everything he was and how he was doing at a time when USC was on probation and Washington was down, why that would be favorable for Oregon as it went about its business. I think that he would still win, though. Look, it's like his first year in Philly, he did a pretty good job. And I thought that the last year in San Francisco, he just got hamstrung by a bunch of ton of different issues. I think that he could have – the thing that seems like maybe hamstrung him in the pros was that it's harder to get maybe some more buy-in from, you know, adults who have other things outside of football. You know, they have contracts and they're not beholden to the coach like college kids are.
Yeah.
I think at the college level, he'd get that buy-in because he is still held in such high regard in the college ranks as being that kind of ahead of the curve innovator.
What, from his era at Oregon, what were you most impressed with?
Probably that first season, how it went from everything is lost against Boise State and even Purdue. They didn't look very good.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden became, at the end of the year, Rose Bowl. You know, I thought that first year was amazing. After that, obviously getting the number one ranking and the title game appearance was extraordinary to watch from the outside as it happened. But I thought that first year, when there really wasn't any momentum, to get it back on the tracks and get to a Rose Bowl was it's pretty remarkable.
He's a pretty stubborn guy. I also think that there's a part of him that really wanted to make it work, and he knew it was going to work, even when people were going, I don't see it, man. This doesn't look like football like we know it. Moving forward, we're talking to Andrew Greif of the Oregonian. He's our Ducks insider. It's Arizona this week. The Ducks need one win for bowl eligibility. What do they do about Khalil Tate?
Well, Willie Taggart said pray, and I think that's a good start. I laid out Khalil Tate's stats today to an Oregon running back, Tony Brooks James, and said, I know you're a running back and he's a quarterback, but he's basically a running back. What do you think about when you watch him play, when you see these stats? And his eyes got big and said, well, I didn't know he'd rush for that many yards. Everyone's really impressed with Khalil Tate. I think that you have to have Troy Dye back in a big way. He got a little hurt against Washington, walked off the field with a strained Achilles heel. He's going to be back this week. But, you know, how effective is he? I think that's going to be so important because he is, I think, the linchpin of this defense still. He's going to be one of those guys who can chase him down. And then you have to gang tackle in general better than they did against Washington. You know, there are a lot of arm tackles that were run through by Miles Gaskin. You can't do that against Khalil Tate.
Is this a bad matchup for Oregon's defense or a favorable matchup, given that Tate is all legs and he's not really going to hurt you throwing the ball?
Well, he could, though. I mean, I know he had 6 picks this year, but he's effective in that they don't ask him to do a ton, but he does enough to kind of keep you guessing. And he's not the only running back, so you have to worry about J.J. Taylor and Nick Wilson, too. So they do have some more weapons than just him, and I think they can do enough where you can't always key on Tate, even though you figure that he will probably be option 1A and 1B.
I also look at Jim Levitt's job this year, and I look statistically at where he is versus, you know, where maybe Brady Hoke was or where Levitt was at Colorado. Can you look at Levitt and say, has he made a difference? Are they on the right track? You know, does he just need better players? What do you see?
I think they're definitely on the right track. I mean, you look at just the running stats. I mean, they've been helped by being healthy for the most part. And Oregon's defense last year was just killed by that. We've talked about that so many times. But health has been one big thing. But I do think that what he's running is better suited for Oregon's personnel. Brady Hoke, when he brought in the four-down lineman look, everyone kind of wondered how that was going to go because Oregon just didn't have that D-line depth, and you needed that to run the 4-3. I think the 3-4 is going to be a little bit better because it allows Oregon this season and will allow them in the future, as long as Levitt's here, to be more flexible in the Pac-12. You need some faster, smaller guys to defend all the wide receivers and the passing threats and the running threats in this conference. And what they've done by turning Lamar Winston, an outside linebacker, into that kind of hybrid guy, that's a really smart thing that Levitt did. I think that's allowed them to be a little bit more of a better matchup against passing teams.
What have you been most intrigued with Willie Taggart's first year?
Gosh, put me on the spot. I mean, sometimes I get you know, as beat writers, we're kind of our heads too far in the sand. Sometimes we don't see the big picture. We're kind of too glossed in on, you know, reading the tea leaves of Justin Herbert every week.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I'm trying to go to 30,000 feet here for you, I think that how even though the season has been, you know, fairly, at least the last half of the season with the injury, how it's been fairly predictable of how Oregon's going to play, it's still been very interesting to watch and follow because Taggart does keep you guessing, does keep it interesting. And so I think what could have been a very blasé experience the last month and a half has actually been pretty interesting to follow, at least from my perspective, just because Taggart, he speaks candidly and doesn't and keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, I think, too, we've gotten caught up, haven't we, and is Herbert in or out? We've really stopped looking at Taggart and the job he's doing. And I kind of think, like, I look at the way they ran the football with Braxton Burmeister at quarterback, and I'm going, they ran the football when everyone in the stadium knew they were running the football.
Yeah, it's no surprise and they were able to do it despite that one-dimensional aspect of the offense against Washington. You know, one of the nation's probably three best rush defenses is a sign that what they do has enough wrinkles and enough good players that they can get yardage. It's just you have to have that second option. You have to have the passing game. And against Washington, I mean, I don't think there was more than two passes that went beyond 10 yards. And that's just striking.
All right. Arizona at home, Oregon State at home. What is Oregon's record in the final two games of this season?
I've picked Arizona to win 41-38 Saturday because I think that even if Herbert returns and Taggart said today it's a good chance he plays, what Marcus Arroyo, the co-OC, said, I think rings true for me. He's going to have rust. You know, he's taken 7 weeks off. I think it would be unfair to Herbert to expect him to come in and play like he did against Nebraska. He's going to play pretty well if he does. I mean, there's no doubt, but I don't think we can just think that he'll step in and throw for 350 yards, three touchdowns. So I think that Tate, the way he's rolling, the momentum he has, could outweigh even a return of Herbert. And then against Oregon State, I think Oregon wins that game. Oregon State just feels very downtrodden right now, and I don't think there's a way Oregon loses that at home.
All right, so I've already plotted a way in which Oregon gets to the Boca Bowl because they're going to have more than six bowl-eligible teams in the Pac-12. But playing in a bowl game gets you the extra practice. Is there anything else that Willie Taggart's after here?
Well, I think with the bowl, it's a little easier to sell progress to recruits and fans and donors. So I think that's psychologically, it's just good to see your team in the postseason. Some fans won't really care where they go, but I think some fans will, you know, want to see how they match up against a non-conference opponent. I think that would be something that a lot of fans would get behind, even though it lacks the prestige of a New Year's Day Bowl.
Andrew Greif, I appreciate you, man.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you. Oregon Ducks, Arizona, Saturday. Tweet me your predictions. I am also picking Arizona to win the game. I think Arizona wins it by a touchdown. He says a field goal. I'd have to pick Oregon in the Civil War if Justin Herbert is playing and he's healthy. A lot of that, though, is contingent upon how he looks. And if you're a Beaver fan, you will rubberneck and try to look at Oregon, Arizona and go, all right, how does Herbert look? Is he back? Can he be healthy? And if you're a Duck fan, like, a lot of the season got derailed. It was about Willie for about 3 or 4 weeks. It was about energy, enthusiasm. What's Taggart doing? And I really felt like, all right, he's on the right track. He's doing. And then I kind of felt like we went into the I don't know phase of Oregon football in their season, because when Herbert got hurt, it suddenly became about survival. And at that point, I don't know that we can judge Willie Taggart on a week-to-week basis coaching. I don't know if we can tell if the offense has really improved. I don't know. And the only thing I came away with really during that stretch of five games where they went 1-4 is that Royce Freeman deserved better. Punch It Audio. All the best sound from all around. Next. show moves fast. That's why you have to be here. That's why you come to the show. It moves fast. We get Tom Chattel of the Omaha World Herald. I wanted to say Tom Chattel in Omaha, and it came out as Tom Hell. Tom Chattel of the Omaha World Herald, who came on to talk about Mike Riley. He said he's done. You put a fork in him, he's over. Oregon State cannot touch Mike Riley. Get that out of your head. There might be some temptation to reach back and go, hey, you know, take that old ex-girlfriend back. She's a known quantity. Seems like a good idea at the time. But there's a reason why you and the ex-girlfriend didn't work out. And in part, it was you got bored with each other. Mike Riley got bored with Oregon State, and frankly, Oregon State got bored with Mike Riley. He had a lot of money left on his contract when he left for Nebraska. He's going to get paid. He still has a house there. I like Riley. I think he's smart. I think he knows football. I also think he's 64 years old. So if you're Oregon State, that's not who you're looking for as your head coach, your next head coach. So get that out of your head. I still think you can rubberneck a little bit if you're Oregon State. You can go, man, what exactly happened there? What went on? Which brings us, of course, to Punch It Audio.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Tom Chattel, Omaha World Herald, talking about Nebraska fans. What do Nebraska fans want, Tom? Punch it.
It's sad in some ways, but you know what? The fans here really didn't get to know him well enough to be, you know, really sad. So they want to win, and they just had the worst loss maybe they've had, you know, since the early 60s on Saturday. They got walked over by Minnesota Gopher. So not good.
Problem with losing like that is it wasn't against Wisconsin or Ohio State. It was against Minnesota. P.J. Fleck rode the boat like he did against Oregon State. He did it against Nebraska. And that is what gets you fired. Mike Riley looked beat in the postgame pressers. Team looked like it quit. And I think Minnesota's better than people give it credit for. I mean, it demoralized Oregon State. It out-physicaled Oregon State. But it's the kind of loss that gets you fired when you don't have success. Bill Moose, the athletic director at Nebraska, says he's got a football coach for two more games. He essentially is saying he is done with Mike Riley himself. This is the problem that I think Nebraska has, though. I think it's a little disillusioned, the fan base at least. I don't think it's the same job that it once was. I think there are better jobs. I think the Florida job's better. I think the Tennessee job's better. I think UCLA's probably a better job if it opens. Nebraska's a good football job, but that's a tough conference. And you're geographically, I don't think you're in the same boat as Iowa. You're in the same boat as Wisconsin. And yeah, those programs have been good, but it's not like the dominant run that I used to think of Nebraska and Oklahoma in the same breath. You know, as somebody who paid attention to college football in the 80s, it was Nebraska, it was Oklahoma. Those were brand name Miami. And now I think Nebraska's got a little tougher climb. And maybe the fan base realizes that. Maybe they don't. Let's stay in college football. Willie Taggart. Willie Taggart was asked, how do you stop Khalil Tate? He's got the answer. Punch it.
Is there anything extra you guys kind of have to do this week to make sure you can contain him on Saturday?
Pray. I mean, he's no one stopped him yet this year. He's a heck of a talent. Big time football player, and he's really good with the ball in his hand.
Goes to show you what having a good football player under center can do for you. Because Rich Rod talked about how much better Khalil Tate made the rest of his team. How much better he talks about playing 11 players. How do we make all 11 guys count on offense? Khalil Tate helps you do that. Is there going to be a real test for Jim Levitt's defense? Because it's a guy that nobody has been able to stop playing against a defense that hasn't been great at stopping people, period, in the last couple years. Rich Rod talked about Khalil Tate
you know, we've morphed a little bit over the years and doing different formations and things like that, but the basis really goes back 20 years, and we always talk about playing with 11. And when you have a guy at quarterback that's a willing runner and can be pretty dynamic at times like Khalil, you truly are playing with 11.
Yeah, you've got to stop him. Since he's been in the starting lineup, it's been 1,000 yards of rushing, 1,207 to be exact, 13 touchdowns. He's averaging 201 yards a game rushing. The Wildcats are 7-3. They're dynamic, they're interesting, and they've got a young quarterback. The only thing Oregon has going for it in this game is the return of Justin Herbert. Maybe the home field, too. Is that enough? If you're a Duck fan, tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT. Give me your prediction for the game. Monday Night Football. Cam Newton. Punch it.
In the shotgun is a quarterback. Newton runs out of the pocket, runs to the numbers, runs to the sideline, throws a pass. It's a diving catch on the side of the end zone, caught by McCaffrey. It is a touchdown for Carolina.
45-21, Carolina dominated Monday Night Football. Cam Newton was good, shouting at teammates, throwing touchdown passes, making jokes in the postgame presser, threw for 254 yards, four touchdowns. Here's Cam.
Just wanted to come out and impose our will. You know, we had an extra day of preparation. We had a great week of practice. But above all, man, we wanted to come out and play Panther football. That's protecting the football. I threw a lackluster ball early on that ended up being incomplete. But for us, coming out each and every play and having that mentality that we want to maximize each and every opportunity that we do get.
He's a funny animal, this guy, Newton. He's likable and unlikable at the same time. He's terrific and also unlikable at the same time. He's going to polarize people because he's, you know, he mentioned that, hey, I threw a ball, lackadaisical ball or whatever he said. You know, on that pass play, he yelled at his receiver after the ball was, it was apparently picked off and then ruled an incompletion. And I love how that stuck with him. But he's now owning it. Earlier, he was shouting at a teammate about it. Weird. Bobby Doerr. Major League Pro Baseball Hall of Famer, made his debut in 1937 with the Boston Red Sox. Passed away yesterday at the age of 99 in Junction City, Oregon. Here he is talking about his Major League debut. Punch it.
I kind of thought maybe I got in over my head a little bit. We opened the season in Philadelphia, and I did pretty well down there. And then we went to Yankee Stadium where I faced Gomez and Monty Pearson and Bump Hadley. Tough pitchers. Hadley and Pearson were just good curveball pitchers. And, of course, Gomez, good stuff. And playing in Yankee Stadium for the first time, I'd never seen any ballpark like that before. And, after seeing the stuff I saw there, I just kind of wondered if I was in over my head a little bit, and I think I could have done better if I would have had a little better feeling about the whole thing.
This is a guy who is a 9-time All-Star. Could have done a little better. Hall of Famer. Lived out his retirement in the state of Oregon. He adopted Oregon as his home after spending a winter fishing for steelhead on the Rogue River. He met his future wife here. And, you know, as a guy that people may remember him as a Boston Red Sox great, but, and they may describe him as a Hall of Famer, but he also served his country in 1945. We were at war, and he took a break from baseball, came back the next year in 46, and helped his team get to the World Series. They lost a Game 7 of the World Series to the Cardinals, and he hit more than 400 in that World Series. Bobby Doerr, age of 99. Enos Kanter getting after LeBron. They had a little on-court confrontation. Punch it.
Coming to my house, playing that water bottle flip game again. You know what I mean? I don't care who you are, king. What do you call yourself? King, queen, princess, whatever you are. You know what? We're going to fight. And nobody out there going to punk us. I mean, come on. You can't just mess with the rookie like that. You know, if you're going to mess with it, go mess with the grown man. You know what I mean? I'll die for my teammates.
LeBron, you hear that?
He can call it what? What is it? Say it again.
You can call yourself king, queen, princess. You're not going to punk us.
Well, I'm the king, my wife is the queen, and my daughter is the princess. So we got all three covered.
What happened with you and Ennis and Frank on that play, then?
Nothing.
Make a dinner reservation?
Never that. You know, nothing. Nothing. I mean, we got the win. That's. I'm not going to get I'm not even going to say that guy's name again. Anyway, so next question, please.
You're not the king of New York. Cantor says, finally, we got something interesting to talk about when it comes to the NBA. And by the way, LeBron may be done talking about it, but he's not done Instagramming about it. He posted an Instagram picture of himself walking over the Knicks logo. Got a million likes on it. We'll talk more about this coming up. John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News will be with us. He's upset about the Pac-12 conference. He's upset at Larry Scott. He's got solutions to fix the conference. I want you to focus specifically on that. I want you to tell me, what about the Pac-12 conference frustrates you the most? Is it the TV deal? And only answer one thing. I don't want you to call in and say it's this and this and this and this. Tell me the thing that is most frustrating to you. Is it the TV deal? Is it the late kickoffs? Is it the fact that the Pac-12 plays each other and beats each other up to the point where you can't get a playoff team? What's the problem with the Pac-12 and what bothers you the most about it? 503-417-7575 is the number. Plus, more on Jerry Jones. He is escalating this feud with the NFL. He will not back down. I'll tell you what he said and what it means and what the other owners in the league are plotting to do. And is Jones for a change in the right, or is he still same old crazy Jerry Jones? Leave it right here. Pac-12 gets you a lot to think about. What's wrong with the Pac-12? I think the TV deal is what bothers me most about the Pac-12 conference. Because you could say, hey, look, they play 9 conference games. This is ridiculous. That's too many opportunities to beat each other up. They should play fewer conference games. Maybe the fact that they have a conference championship game is good or bad. I don't know if that bothers you. The late kickoffs, maybe that bothers you. What is it that the Pac-12 does that is the biggest burr in your saddle? We'll talk with the burr in the Pac-12 saddle, John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News, coming up top of the hour. But I want yours in front of that. 503-417-7575. Cool thing happened on yesterday's show. On the program, we were joined by Ted Wynn. If you missed it, you're going to grab the podcast. You're going to listen to it later. You're going to share it with friends and family because Ted is 48. He's got brain cancer. He's got a rare form of brain cancer. And he's been battling it now for a few years. And he has been told by doctors, hey, you may not make the weekend. Ted joined us on the show yesterday and talked about his mortality, more or less. Talked about what it is to know that you're in this position. He's got 2 children. And what it is to know that you're in this position, you're fighting for your life, and you may not get out of it. And he was profound, and he was interesting, and he was dynamic, and he talked, too, about the messages that he's gotten from people like Marshall Faulk, who have sent him video messages. Here's Faulk.
Hey, Ted, what's up? It's Marshall Faulk. I hear you're a big, big Rams fan. And I heard that you're going through something right now, man. Keep up the fight, and I hope you a speedy recovery.
And Johnny Hecker of the Rams, the current punter with the Rams, sent a little note.
Just keep grinding. My wife and I'll be praying for you and believing that, you know, you're going to be this thing yet again.
And Derek Anderson of the Carolina Panthers, backup quarterback there.
I just want to send you a quick note, just to let you know there's a lot of people out there thinking about you. Keep fighting and go Beavs, bud.
And Ryan Allen, the punter of the Patriots.
Be strong. We're all with you. And when I get back into Oregon, lunch is on me. You can pick the place, but it's my treat.
So also he got a note from, or a video message from Steven Spielberg. He got a video message from Wayne Tinkle. He got a video message from Al Gore, the former vice president. So, I mean, it's like he looks at these things and they lift his spirits. Well, a cool thing happened today, and I'm guessing it came through Gliss, but the Los Angeles Rams, a guy named Chase Isaacs, who works in the front office of the Los Angeles Rams, sent me an email this morning saying that he works with the Rams, and he caught word of Ted Wynn's situation and heard the podcast of it on yesterday's show, and Wynn is a huge Rams fan. And he said, we'd like to send him a care package with some Rams items in it. So they were looking for his mailing address. So I reached out to Ted and said, we need your mailing address. And his wife texted me back and she said, how exciting. So it's those little things. It's those little gestures. And I'm curious on yesterday's show, because I encouraged people yesterday to reach out to people if you know somebody who's sick. To reach out and to let them know that you're thinking about them. Because it was part of what we talked about is how awkward that is. Those exchanges can be when you know somebody's sick. And I'm curious if you did that. And I'm curious if that's how it went down. And also, somebody else with the Rams has just emailed me too. This is really interesting. So Jose, who works for the Rams, said he grew up in Milwaukee, just sent me an email, just got it right now. He says his dad is an avid listener of this radio show. Dad is who sent the interview and the newspaper column to Jose. And the Rams are sending something to Ted. And also, it's cool to see that there's an Oregon connection there with the Rams. But I'm curious if you reached out. I'm curious. See, the Los Angeles Rams are reaching out. I'm curious if you reached out to somebody that you know. I'm curious if you took the time to send a text message or make a phone call or Facebook post or something to somebody out there that you know may be sick that you know. We all know people who are in need of connection and encouragement. I think it's such a simple thing, and it's such an easy thing, and I'm struck by that as the Los Angeles Rams, now two executives with the Rams, one in corporate sponsorships and one in communications, has reached out to me and said, hey, help us out here because we're trying to, you know, at least give this guy a little bit of our attention and our time. If you haven't done it already, it's not too late. Do it today. Like, don't let an opportunity pass to maybe make a difference with somebody. 503-417-7575. If you want to tell me about the phone call you made or the text message you sent, if you've been moved by Ted Wynn's story, and frankly, if you are somebody who's uptight in frustrated with what's going on with the Pac-12. Was that not great perspective yesterday? Like, because sometimes I will complain. I'll be like, man, there's not enough hours in the day. For example, I've been getting a lot of grief because I posted a tweet that featured a screenshot of my iPhone, and it showed that I had like 80,000 email messages that were unchecked. And currently, the number of text messages, it drives some people crazy. I have 76 text messages that are unchecked, and I have 6 voicemails, and I had 80,000 emails. And I'm not bringing that up to be like, oh, I'm so busy. I'm bringing it up because, like, I just can't get to the voicemail. I can't get to the text message. I can't get to the email. There's certain things I have to do, and it's like I'm not going to not interact with the 3-year-old or the 1-year-old or the 15-year-old and go check a bunch of voicemails. But I started doing something the other night that's highly addictive. I'm a little bit addicted to this. I have been deleting emails. I'm not opening them. I'm finding people who have sent me like 1,200 emails because I'm just saying, all right, this person emails me a lot. So I put their name into the search thing and like 1,200 of their emails come up and I'm going to go, okay, I'm going to delete all of these. I have whittled down 80,000 emails to 61,452. So there we go. We're on our way to zero. I don't know what I'm going to do when I get to zero. But I also noticed overnight that like Jimmy Shapiro, who's with Bovada, which puts out odds for the college football playoff and everything else, he emailed me 6 times overnight. And that's really like, can he just send me one? I know it's randomly generated. I get it. It's like spam. But it's like, can we limit your spam to one each? I want to like personally respond to each one of those 6 emails that I got from Jimmy's spam account just so Jimmy has to answer 6 emails back. And it's not like it bugs me because he's putting odds on who's going to make the college football playoff. Will Alabama make the playoff? Will Auburn make the playoff? Will Clemson make it? And tonight we're going to get the rankings again. And tonight's top four in the college football rankings are going to be fascinating because we're going to find out what this committee is going to do with the Notre Dame loss. What are they going to do with Georgia, who is sitting at number one? What are they going to do with Auburn? Auburn's got 2 losses, but they're quality losses. Auburn right now is 2-1 to make the playoff. I don't think that they're going to be in the top four on this round, but it's not an awful proposition to think, like, is it possible that Auburn could get into the playoff? And if they do, what does that mean for Alabama if that happens to go down that way? So we will keep an eye on the playoff. I'm going to give you my 4 teams, the teams that I think right now are the most deserving to be in the college football playoff next. Tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT, and tell me the 4 that you're picking. And if you reached out to somebody that is sick or in need of a little encouragement after hearing Ted Wynn's interview, you can tweet at me as well. And I just want to know that you got that message. And if you haven't done it, do it. If you have a neighbor, a coworker, a friend, a family member who you think needs encouragement like Ted Wynn got from those NFL players, don't leave it to the NFL players to be doing all the encouragement themselves. Shoot a note to somebody who's in need, who's sick, who might just need a little pick-me-up. You got the Bald-Faced Truth. You're listening on the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Network, where you're listening in Fox Sports Eugene or in Klamath Falls on 93.3 FM or in Portland on 102.9 and 750 The Game. John's Waterproofing, bettercrawlspaces.com. That's the website you need to know. It's going to be wet out there this winter, and it's probably already moisture on the ground wherever you live. You don't want that in your crawl space. You don't want that in your basement. If you have a concern about it, if you don't like the way, hey, funny smell down here. I don't like the way it smells. It smells a little mildewy or musty. Call John's Waterproofing or get in touch with them by going to bettercrawlspaces.com. That's the URL you need to know. You can contact them on phone as well at 877-526-8141. That's 877-526-8141. This is a good company. Do great work. Their service area basically includes anywhere that you're listening to this show. Greater Portland area, Salem, Beaverton, Eugene, Vancouver, wherever you may be. bettercrawlspaces.com or 877-526-8141. All right, here's my college football take for the day. You've got the College Football Playoff Selection Committee, which has been roped into this ranking thing that they have to release every week on ESPN as part of the television deal. And that's right, this is included. See, when ESPN bought the rights to the College Football Playoff, and ESPN's in the event business, you know that. But it was a 12-year deal that they signed in November of 2012, and it gives them the playoff games, plus it gives them each of the 6 associated bowl games for 12 years. The CBSSports.com says that the deal is worth about $5.5 billion over 12 years. It's about $470 million annually that it comes down to. It gives ESPN the rights to those games that I mentioned, plus it gives them the rights to the selection announcements, and it gives them the rights to the NCAA tournament style selection show, plus it gives them the rights to these Tuesday night announcements. And we are currently in what is this, week 3 of the announcements, 3rd of 6 weeks that they do it. So who's the number one team in America? I want you to make a case. I'm going to give you the candidates. You tell me who should be number one in this ranking. The phone number is 503-417-7575. It's Alabama. It's Miami. It's Clemson. It's Oklahoma. It's Wisconsin. Or is it someone else? Who should be the number one team when the rankings come out tonight? Because if you're making a case for Alabama, usually the Alabama fan goes, well, we're Alabama. That's how that argument starts and ends. The problem that Alabama has is that they've defeated their first 8 unranked opponents by a blowout margin of like 33 points or better. Then they had the last 2 weeks, they had back-to-back wins against LSU and Mississippi State. But when you look at them, they're outscoring their opponents by 4 touchdowns a game. That's the best scoring margin in football. And they're allowing only 10 points per game. That's the low in FBS. They play elite defense. They get enough on offense. Their strength of record is number 2. But should Alabama be the number 1 team? Because Miami's making a strong case. Miami beat Notre Dame, which was the committee's number 3 team, 41-8. Just whacked them. And Miami, against Power 5 opponents, has done something that has not happened in the last 15 years. They are the first team in major college football to force at least 4 turnovers in 4 straight games against Power 5 opponents since 2004. Their turnover differential is plus 15. It's the best in the Power 5. Wyoming is plus 17, but that's Wyoming. Is Miami the best team? Should Miami have the number 1 ranking after whacking Notre Dame? Because everybody looks at Notre Dame and they say, oh, Georgia was number 1. Georgia beat Notre Dame by 1 point. Miami just beat Notre Dame 41-8. The committee has to pay attention to that. Clemson, do you put Clemson number 1? They lost to Syracuse, but everybody said, hey, their quarterback didn't play in that game. Kelly Bryant. And injuries count. Clemson has 3 wins against top 25 teams, including a win over Auburn, who's coming on here. Now, Auburn just knocked off Georgia, the number 1 team. Clemson's number 2 in scoring defense in their conference. They're number 3 in scoring offense. And with the exception of Florida State, every opponent that Clemson has faced is 500 or better. 5 of their 9 opponents have already attained bowl eligibility. It's a good schedule. The resume for Clemson is clear, but are they the number 1 team? How about Oklahoma? You can nitpick Oklahoma, but I'm impressed with what they did to TCU. TCU was number 6. And heading into Saturday's game, TCU had averaged less than 2 touchdowns a game. Oklahoma scored 38 in the first half. Baker Mayfield is a Heisman Trophy candidate and is the front runner. 71 touchdowns to 13 interceptions in his last 23 games. They have 3 wins over top 25 teams. 2 of those are on the road at Ohio State, at Oklahoma State. They're a 1-loss team, but they're at the front of the 1-loss team rankings. Do you put Oklahoma in your 4? And if so, are they number 1? I don't think so. Wisconsin is undefeated. And if it's just about being undefeated, does Wisconsin deserve to be in the top 4? All Wisconsin has done is beat everybody they've scheduled. But they just beat number 20, Iowa. They have the lowest strength of schedule against any of the top 25 teams ranked this week. They've already clinched the Big Ten West Division, so they'll get a ranked opponent in the conference championship game. But right now, their best win, what is it? Is it Northwestern? They're 25th. Is it Iowa? They're 20th. Does Wisconsin belong in the top 4? For me, I'm really tempted to make Miami the number 1 team, but it's hard to argue with Alabama. What would you do? George is in Woodburn. George, welcome.
Hey, how's it going, Don?
Going all right.
Okay, here we go. Bama, no doubt. Auburn, number 2. I got Oklahoma in 3, and then I got to pick them with Miami and Clemson. I think that's how it's going to shake out. And then after that, there's going to be a lot of carnage below that, so I don't know who would be.
The problem for me comes after about two, and it comes at the minute you put Auburn in, and Auburn, you know, I think Auburn is going to get a lot of run for the rankings. They're gonna move up. They were sitting at 10. They're going to move up in the rankings, but I think that, you know, the highest I could see Auburn placed after this is at about 7 or 8. So I think Auburn's got to leapfrog a lot of people to get there. Georgia's going to drop out of the top four. Alabama is probably going to be number one. Notre Dame, you're out. Clemson's still in. So I have Alabama, Clemson, Oklahoma, and I'm going to put Miami as my fourth. Wisconsin and Auburn are right there, though, right off the pace. It's why, see, I keep thinking we need 8. We don't need 16. I had a friend email me, and he says, can you start banging the drum for my 16-team playoff? And I'm going, we don't need 16. Because it falls apart after, you know, who are the contenders in college football? It's Alabama. It's Clemson. It's Oklahoma. It's Miami. It's Wisconsin. It's Auburn. Then it kind of gets, all right, USC. We can talk about Georgia. Did they have just a bad game? Notre Dame, I'm done with you. Just because I want to be done the minute Notre Dame's out. TCU, I'm done with you too. Oklahoma eliminated you. So I kind of, you know, two lost teams. The only two lost team that I would look at are Auburn and USC. And I think you need, at some point, you need to start talking about 8. And that some point comes in 2025. He thinks Auburn's going to end up in it, and they might. But I also think, can you really put Auburn and Alabama both in the playoff? And what, you know, if you do that, you've got, you know, obviously the big 12 is going to be looking at you going, hey, excuse me, but can we get Oklahoma in this thing for sure? Okay, you're in. Then what about Miami? Miami in? I think after what they did in Notre Dame, you kind of have to look at Miami. You know, Miami's 8-9-0. 503-417-7575 is the phone number. Feel free to weigh in on that. The Pac-12 conference has got a lot of problems. John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News says he has the solutions. And I like that. I like people who aren't just bitching. I like people who are going to come on the show and offer a solution. What are we going to do to fix the Pac-12? And why won't Larry Scott, the Pac-12 commissioner, grant an interview? What's he so busy doing? Getting people out of trouble in China? I think it's interesting that, by the way, did the president play a role in that, getting those guys free in China? He was over there. Can we get him some big baller shoes for the guy in the White House? Wouldn't that? Aren't they perfect for each other, President Trump and LeVar?
I would love to see a conversation between those two.
I think you are terrific. You're just terrific. I think your shoes are amazing and terrific. We could probably dub something together. It would be really, really funny. All right, John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News, is coming up. Leave it here. And make sure you're subscribed to the BFT radio show on SoundCloud and iTunes.
So I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
Okay. Here we go.
The bald-faced truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
This portion of the bald-faced truth is brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights. Need a machinery job done right? Call High Caliber today.
John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News is a burr in the Pac-12 saddle. He joins us now. How are you, man?
Just calling him like I see him.
They bring some of this on themselves, don't they?
Well, they have, yes, and some of it is, you know, out of their control and out of nowhere. And to me, those are the telling. You know, it's telling when Chris Fowler, one of the faces of ESPN College Football with 750,000 Twitter followers, just kind of takes a pot shot at the Pac-12 network out of nowhere. You know, and this is just a couple of weeks after Herb Street has done that. So it has been a very interesting couple months.
I loved what you posted about. First of all, let's go back to Friday. Washington plays Stanford on Friday. I didn't even know there was pickup truck racing. What happened?
Yeah, me neither. Well, it's actually the second Friday in a row that that happened. The UCLA Utah was also the 7:30 Friday window on FS1, and the racing went long that night as well, but because of a few factors that we only missed a few a minute or two of that game. The Washington Stanford game was completely different because the racing went, 45 minutes long or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like the end of a NCAA tournament game. It went on forever. And so they have got the racing up against the football window. And if the racing goes long, it's a problem because they're obligated to show the trophy ceremony for the racing.
That's bizarre. I just kept thinking, why are we watching this? This is like this football can't take a back seat to this.
Well, it shouldn't. And the part of the problem, too, is that I think Fox didn't think it through. Instead of switching to FS2, which Comcast Seattle and I guess Comcast Portland doesn't get it either, they should have switched to a Fox family network that was available for the major carriers in the Northwest, like FX or Fox Business.
John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News, is with us. Wilner, you wrote you've got some solutions for the Pac-12, and I love that you're coming up with solutions. What is it that you talked about? What is it that you know that the Pac-12 should be doing?
Basically, the Pac-12 needs to form a governing body of Pac-12 football that is devoted to producing the best product possible year in and year out, kind of modeled after the NFL Competition Committee. Certainly have to work within the parameters of NCAA legislation, but get a representative from every team, from every school, and have them have final say on matters of scheduling, oversight of officiating, any practice policies, postseason policies. Give the authority to a central body whose sole purpose is to the betterment of the conference. And see what happens over time.
Is it that others have done a better job, or is it just that college football has shifted and the Pac-12 has fallen behind, or how do you read what's happened here?
Part of it is that the Pac-12 is different. They have got a different TV deal, right? The Pac-12 networks as a wholly owned property is different than any other conference network. Part of it is that they are dealing with the issue of the time zone, which is not the Pac-12's fault. It's just the reality. It seems like there are enough natural obstacles for Pac-12 football to thrive nationally that it makes sense to have a body dedicated to making, every decision for the betterment of the conference. The other thing that it has different is the TV the TV contracts are different with the Thursday and Friday night games, and that obviously adds a dynamic to the football season that other conferences don't have to deal with.
We asked for Larry Scott on yesterday's show, made a request with the Pac-12. They said Larry's busy for the next couple weeks, and I kind of just laughed because I thought he doesn't want to come on and talk about Friday night. He doesn't want to come on and talk about the fact that there's probably not a playoff team here. Would he be better served?
Yeah.
Would he be better served facing the music and getting his messaging out there?
Well, he probably doesn't want to talk about China either.
Yeah.
the thing about Scott is that I'll give the guy full credit for is he makes himself available to the media. Every football game he attends, he has a halftime gaggle with reporters, and I have never seen him refuse to answer a question. He doesn't always have specific answers, but he is out there. And I don't know why he said no, and it could be that they are kind of recalibrating or retrenching. I'm not quite sure. But in general, I give him a lot of credit for being out there. It has been a rough couple months, though.
Yeah, what I want to hear from him is, yeah, the next time we do those TV deals, we're going to do a better job of looking at how we can better serve fans. Maybe that's just a diplomatic response, but I want to hear that from him. And instead, I kind of just get this repeat of, well, it's the deal we have. It's the reality of college football. And it just aggravates me.
No, that's understandable. I mean, and certainly fans are very frustrated too. I think a lot of the, you know, a lot of the problem is was rooted in the negotiations themselves 7-8 years ago. It was handled by Scott with the president's sign off and with his media consultants, and a lot of things that they did in doing those TV deals were innovative and worked well. I think the tier one deal they got with ESPN and Fox was the best deal they could possibly have gotten. But at the same time, the athletic directors were not really involved. Those are the men and women on the front lines. They may have raised a flag about the night games or about the 6-day windows or whatever. And I don't know, might have changed something, it might not have, but at least the consideration that the folks on the campuses have, the challenges that the folks on the campuses have, may have been had a larger voice in the negotiations.
Yeah, and I wonder, it feels like Ed Ray at Oregon State is a big supporter of Larry Scott. Given what we see in the NFL with Roger Goodell sort of eroding some relationships, you feel like Scott, with the new contract, that he's on good terms and that the university presidents that he works for all sort of understand the reality?
I think so. It's an interesting dynamic because there's only three presidents who are on the team that hired him.
Yeah.
Ray, Crow at ASU, and Gene Block at UCLA. There has been a ton of turnover, even in the last 2 years, at the presidential level. And so a lot of the new presidents and chancellors are coming in with, you know, concerns being raised left and right. Washington State's Kirk Schultz was the first, you know, a month ago to really go public with a little bit of skepticism. Until that point, there had been a real united front. But I also think if you're president or chancellor of a multi-billion dollar university, you're looking for dumpster fires, and I don't think they would think that Pac-12 football and basketball right now are nearly at the level of a dumpster fire.
Wilner, I am looking at the North and South Division. Who do you think ends up in that championship game, and is USC still have a shot, you think, at a playoff?
I think that they've got a shot only in like an alternate universe deal. They need so much help to get in with two losses, and not only two losses, but one of them is a 35-point loss. So I think that they're you know, not a reasonable path into the playoff for USC. But they will be the favorite in the Pac-12 title game, right? Because they're done this week. UCLA is their last game. They're going to have a bye before the title game. So whether they're playing one of the Washington schools or Stanford, that team is going to be playing on a short week, and the Trojans are going to be coming off a bye. So that's going to be a big advantage for them. But I just don't know how they're going to get in with two losses, especially if Notre Dame has two losses. There's no way USC is getting in ahead of Notre Dame.
I have a Heisman vote, and I'm looking at Khalil Tate. He's coming to Oregon, and Bryce Love at Stanford. Who should be the Heisman candidate in the Pac-12?
Well, I think it should be, at this point, it should be Love, just because, you know, as incredible as Tate has been, it's six games, and Love has been doing it either at Tate's level or slightly below for a longer period of time over the course of the season. I mean, he was ripping off, you know, 50, 60-yard touchdown runs in September when Tate was not playing. So Tate is phenomenal. He'll be a Heisman candidate, you know, for a couple of years to come, I'm sure. But if I were going to pick one, I would give my vote to Love, just for his, you know, the longevity of this season.
Tate's interesting to me because I'm torn. Like, Rich Rod came on this show yesterday and he made a case that Tate's helping him recruit because guys want to play with him. He's a young player. They want to be around him. But if I'm a wide receiver, do I want to play in that offense with Tate throwing the football?
Yeah, good question. I mean, they do look downfield. You know, the whole thing is that you get the defense paying too much attention to Tate and hit him downfield. So if you're a receiver who doesn't mind having the being targeted, you know, five times a game with a good chance to have a couple big plays, great. If you're a receiver who wants 8-10 catches a game, it's probably not the offense for you.
Wilner, Oregon, Arizona, who you got?
Who's playing quarterback for the Ducks?
Let's say Herbert.
I got the Ducks.
You believe?
I think they'll win both if he's back. And it's a perfect time. It didn't make sense to me they were going to play him against Washington because of the Husky defense and because of the bye coming up. But boy, this is the perfect time. And I think the Ducks will be that. Buys this time of year are unbelievably advantageous, and that is 2 weeks for Levitt to get those guys ready for Tate, and if Herbert can actually give them some kind of downfield passing game, I think they'll win.
Wilner, love you, man. I appreciate you coming on.
Anytime, my friend. Thanks for having me.
John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News. Follow him on Twitter. Read him. He's a resource. He's picking Oregon over Arizona. What do you say? Tweet at me at John Canzano BFT. And up next, we're going to talk about the biggest stadium scam in the world. Costs you a lot of money to go see a sporting event these days. I was looking back. Game 5 of the NBA Finals last year, a fan reportedly paid the most money ever paid for NBA tickets. Game 5, floor seats, two floor seats. Game 5 of the NBA Finals last year. What do you think a fan paid for two seats to Game 5 of the NBA Finals last year? Gliss, you'd produce this show? I think you have a good sense on... floor seats will still cost you for a regular season game anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500 to sit on the floor. Game 5 of the finals, two of them, what'd they cost?
I'm going to go $10,000.
Okay. Droz, you're the air traffic controller.
Let's go $25,000.
You guys on the Price is Right would both suck. A buyer paid $133,000 last year for two seats to Game 5 of the NBA Finals. I am cringing when I'm looking at the average ticket prices for NBA games, the average ticket prices for NFL games. And again, the most expensive tickets... the Warriors tickets, the Knicks tickets, and I'm not even talking about like face value. Even on the secondary market, the tickets are ridiculous price. So a ticket bureau priced tickets on the secondary ticket market for this season. Okay, 30 NBA teams on the secondary ticket market. We're not talking about the deals that the team gives. And the Golden State Warriors average ticket price on the secondary market is $240 a ticket. It's not worth it. And I know we could talk about, by comparison, the average Blazers ticket on the secondary market is $75. I still don't think it's worth it. You're kind of going, maybe? Is it worth it just for you, or do you take the whole family?
I don't know. It depends on where the seats are, all that. I mean, because I've seen secondary tickets, like, if you're looking anywhere near the 200 or 100 level, it's a couple $100.
Yeah. But if I tell you, look, we're going to get you, you have four kids. Three of them would be ticket buyers, I'm sure, because the baby, you could hold the baby. So you're looking at five tickets. Even at the $75 ticket range, which would probably be one of the cheaper 200-level tickets, you think, or a 300-level good seat, maybe mid-court, down low in the 300-level, $75?
No, not worth it.
Yeah. Because we could complain, like, I go to the games, and sometimes I'm going to eat dinner at the arena or whatever, and I go, hey, I'm going to go out onto the concourse, and I start looking at, like, the price of things, and I'll pay it because I'm going to expense it, but I'll look up, and I'll be like, gosh, if we had the whole family here, by the time we get done with tickets, are we going to eat at the arena, park, okay? You're going to park anywhere near the arena. You're paying $20, $25 to park. And then the kids are going, oh, can I get the foam finger or the cotton candy, or hat or a T-shirt? And at the end of this thing, like, you're out like a week's pay.
Yeah, I don't think there's much under $10 when you walk the concourse. No matter what you're getting, pretty much everything is right around $10 a piece.
What's the worst value in any sporting event that you've been to? I want you to tell me what you go in and you go, that is just the worst value. Is it the parking that you cringe at? Is it the cost of concessions that you cringe at? Is it, we don't eat at the stadium, or we don't eat at the arena. We either bring food. When I was a kid, we used to go to San Jose State football games, and it was a cheap ticket. It was probably like a $5 ticket at that time. Spartan Stadium, and we would make hot dogs like that morning, and we'd wrap them in tin foil, and so they look like old ladies. These hot dogs were all wrinkly, and the bun was all soggy, and you got, this hot dog has had a better day early hours ago, but it was, we weren't buying the stadium food. And that was even before now, where it's like, you know, $9 or $11 for a beer, $8.50 for a hot dog. So what is it that you just cringe at when you go into a stadium? Because at $75 on the secondary market, the Blazers, you know, they're about average on those ticket prices. Talking secondary market, because somebody from the NBA team is going to be like, hey, that's not our ticket price. The Warriors are $240. The Lakers are at $150. The Knicks are at $190. The Spurs are at $100. Average ticket, $100. Who's going to the games? 503-417-7575. Tell me what you cringe at when you go to the stadium. Is it simply going to the stadium or the arena? Mike's in Portland. Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, man. Not so much about the prices of things. I mean, that's just kind of general inflation. Trying to take the family to a movie.
Is it,
though?
Don't
buy a nice shirt.
Don't buy anything. Yeah, but I think...
My main thing...
Hold on. But I want to talk about this. I can go to a movie, and I think the inflation of going to a movie is way more reasonable than what's happened in sports.
I agree.
Because, like, when you were a kid, what did it cost to go to a movie?
Like $5.
Yeah, it was $5. And what are we at now?
Yeah, but my dad was like 10 cents or something.
Yeah.
So. It's probably, what, like 12, 15 bucks?
Now we're at 12 or 15, but I went to a football game for $5, and I'm not getting into a football game now for anything under, what, 40?
I've never seen tickets that cheap.
75? Anyway, go ahead, Mike. You want to talk about TV? Let's go.
I do. And I got to get a little pushback here on this, because the two TV deals that you really have problems with are the Blazers and the Pac-12.
Yes.
And there's a big commonality between those two that is the problem. And I think you kind of forget, because it's your service and you like it a lot, that the commonality is DirecTV. Like, I have never had DirecTV, and I've had zero problems with anything whatsoever. Like, Blazer games, you can watch on so many different streaming sources legally and purchase them on Dish Network, on this and that, and on all kinds of fun stuff. Just like the Pac-12, you can get it all kinds of different ways. There are two main problems, you know, between the two of them, and both of them always go back to DirecTV, not providing it. So I'm curious why you don't push back on DirecTV as much as you do these two individual entities for the things that they have.
The problem Friday was Fox Sports 1, which is a whole nother deal. It wasn't a DirecTV Comcast thing. I am frustrated with Comcast, which tried to change its name to NBC Sports Northwest to make you forget about how crappy the service is. But it's a rebranding. Don't be fooled. The problem on Friday was the Washington-Stanford game, which the television deal with the Pac-12 is, you know, is allotted to a Friday night game on Fox Sports 1, which is fine. It's available to everyone. It's a big football game. It should be on. But the problem is, Fox has pickup truck racing that is on before it, and they couldn't keep the damn trucks on the track. And then they're contractually obligated to show the post-race, you know, victory ceremony. So what happens? Fox Sports 1 says, oh, we'll just push it over to Fox Sports 2. The problem is, the people in the Seattle area couldn't get Fox Sports 2. It's not available. Same thing in Portland. You couldn't watch it. If you had DirecTV, you couldn't watch it. You were watching pickup truck racing. So to me, the big picture is the Pac-12 TV deal stinks. They sold out to ESPN, which I understand. They took on the Thursday night games. They took on the Friday night games with Fox. That I get. I get what you're doing there. But it has dramatically increased the lack of visibility for the conference. It's caused people on the East Coast, they're watching the 2 o'clock in the morning, the football game's on. They're not watching it. And then beyond that, my problem, I do have a problem with Comcast in that it's not available. And you bring up streaming options like 58-year-old Martha, who's living in Woodburn, is going to go, oh, yeah, I'll just go over and stream that on my Xbox. Not happening. See, it's a distribution issue. And the Pac-12, here's the problem. There are two missions when you cut a TV deal, if you're the Pac-12. Either distribution and or revenue. That's it. Those are the two things that matter. Distribution and revenue. If you have distribution, I would understand why you don't have revenue. Like if you just chose, hey, we're going to have wide distribution, we're going to be widely available, everybody's going to get to see our games, but we're not going to make as much money. But we think that the trade-off is we're going to have wide distribution. You can make that argument to me and I'd sit there and go, hey, at least you have some rationale behind it. Or if you said, we are going to have revenue stream coming out our ears. We understand we're not getting distribution, but the money was just too much to pass up. I would also understand that argument. But what the Pac-12 did is it chose a model that gives you neither wide distribution nor maximum dollars. It's insanity. You don't have visibility for recruiting. You have people like the caller calling in saying, it's very easy. You can watch it on all kinds of fun stuff. Yeah, I can get it on Dish, or I can switch my provider and get it here, or I can get an Xbox there, or I can buy Sling Blocks and have a neighbor get it, and I can sling it over to my house. And that's just not working for a lot of people. Just make it available like every other conference in America. And Comcast, if it's being real, and I've talked to the people involved in negotiating the deal, I've seen the numbers from both DirecTV and from Comcast or NBC Sports Northwest. It's the same entity. I have seen both sides of it. Comcast will now tell you they made a dramatic mistake in not taking these games on and setting their number too high. They made a mistake. And DirecTV would like to rectify that, but I don't know if DirecTV has any interest in it. I don't think they need them. I don't think they need the Pac-12 network. I don't think they need the Blazers. They're just, you know, sitting back going, hey, we're cool. But we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that have, in revenue that have been lost by not having these games available. And the guy's asking me why I have a problem with it. It isn't about me. It's about the 40 people I hear from on Friday night. The 40 people I hear from on Saturday, the 40 people I hear from on Sunday, the 40 people on Monday, and they are really at their wits' end, and they just want to watch their team. Leave it right here. That caught my eye today on Oregon Live. Apparently in Hawaii, there's some lava flowing out of one of the volcanoes. Somebody put a GoPro camera there, and then I guess the lava went over the camera. And you would think, I would have thought the camera just would have burst into flames or whatever, like the movies. But it didn't. The camera kept filming. So there's some pretty amazing video of the lava overtaking this thing. Also on Oregon Live, another story caught my eye. Former Oregon State football player Jordan Pace has been arrested on four charges, including rape. According to Benton County Circuit Court, grand jury accused the 19-year-old of first-degree rape, among other things. All the charges are felonies. He was arraigned on Monday. He pled not guilty to all four charges. Apparently, this happened on or about May 14th, according to the court documents. The Oregon State Athletic Department says Pace was no longer active as of June 6th. I got a problem with this. I get that Oregon State doesn't want to claim him. I get that. I think it's important. I kind of cringed at the idea, though, that Oregon State must have known. Just like we blame Oregon, we say Oregon should have known. Oregon State must have known Jordan Pace was in some trouble. And they washed their hands of it, and I don't know, did he continue at school? It should have, I guess, the story is, the real story, because the headline's accurate, former Oregon State football player arrested on rape charges. The story's accurate. He was arraigned, and the incident happened May 14th, and he was no longer a football player as of June 6th. But technically, he was an Oregon State football player when he committed this crime. But Oregon State gets to say he's a former player. And I get it. It's a nuance. It's semantics. People are like, come on, Canzano. But, you know, he was a walk-on at Oregon State. He wasn't arrested until this week. I get the ground that you have to stand on, but I just don't like this crime, first of all. Nobody should. But I always cringe at, like, okay, well, he wasn't our guy, but you brought him to campus. Did you? I know he walked on. Did they bring him to campus? Was he a preferred walk-on? I'd say the same thing at Oregon. Like, Dana Altman, like, plausible deniability. I didn't know what was going on. Well, you bring these guys to campus, you better damn well know what's going on. All of them. Football players, basketball players, baseball players, volleyball players. The coaches in these respective sports do not get a free pass. They don't get to say, hey, former, it wasn't our guy. After they commit a crime and they've go, hey, he's no longer with the program. You don't get to do that. And you don't get to do it at Oregon either. I think it goes for all things. I'm not picking on anybody today. I'm picking on everybody. Another story in the news, Hamilton tickets are going on sale on Friday in Portland. Are you going to see Hamilton?
Why did you say that? I was trying to get tickets on Friday. I'm trying to keep it on the down low so that no one else gets tickets before me.
It's only the top story on Oregon Live today.
I know.
What's the thing about Hamilton? Tell me, because you want to go.
Yeah, the thing is, so we're going to take my brother and sister-in-law. We've been talking about it for months. And they just announced that the tickets are going on sale on Friday, and they're expected to sell out very, very quickly. So you got to be ready to go at 10 a.m. on Friday.
Secondary market on those?
Yeah, they've already, some people that have the season passes have already posted tickets up to like $3,500.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Like floor seats to the Warriors.
Now, there is one extra way you can't, they actually do a lottery system. They give away 40 tickets in the orchestra per show. Obviously, you got to take your chances, but it's only $10 if you get selected for the lottery.
That's like the NBA teams go, hey, we got some $10 seats. Why do they do that? Just so everyone has a chance to go?
Yeah, I think the original idea back when it was on Broadway was so that people that, you know, maybe couldn't afford tickets or wouldn't have a chance to get tickets would be able to see the show.
So you're going to be ready Friday like you've never been ready before.
I'm going to be ready.
This is going to be like the biggest thing of your week. Now I've blown it by telling all of our listeners about this thing. So don't have Gliss not be able to go to see Hamilton. There's multiple shows, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's running from, I think, March 20th through April 8th. So, yeah, there's, you know.
What's the hoopla on this thing? I mean, what is this?
Well, I mean, it's basically...
I know nothing about it.
Okay, it's basically become the most successful musical of all time, but I guess the thing that's unique about it is it's basically taking one of our founding fathers, and it's telling the story of his life kind of in a... You know, it's basically a hip-hop show. Like, the music is all hip-hop. And the guy that wrote it, he had read a book on vacation about Alexander Hamilton, autobiography or something like that, and basically thought, you know, the whole way that he died with him having a duel with Aaron Burr, he was like, this is pretty much like Biggie and Tupac. This is a hip hop story. And so he kind of, put his mind to it and started writing songs for it. And there you go.
I have no idea. This was such a big deal. Well, I might sign up for the lottery now. See if I can get
sign up for the lottery.
What will you be mad if I get tickets? Because I'm the jackass who doesn't know anything about this thing. You told me about it.
Well, I mean, Oregon Live told you about it, but no. I mean,
but you could have said, like, it's nothing.
I realize that's why I've been keeping an eye on it. I realize that there's going to be a lot of people trying to get tickets, so I'm going to be ready at 10 a.m. on Friday to try to get some tickets.
This is kind of like your Halloween party that you didn't invite me to. I feel like you only invited me because I found out. And now you're only telling me about this because I found out. Would you have told me? I had no,
because I didn't want anybody else to know. I was hoping that it would just go under everybody's radar. But by the way, you're invited to the Halloween party next year.
Oh, thank you. Did you invite
first
anybody else?
First invitation of the year.
No. Did you do it on Facebook?
Not yet.
Yeah, invite me on Facebook. Then I'll believe it's real. All right. If you're going to see Hamilton, you have an extra ticket. Maybe take Gliss with you. Let him tag along. If you want to. The Dallas Cowboys. I want to talk about Jerry Jones coming up. And I can't talk about Jerry Jones without playing my favorite Jerry Jones clip. Because if you are a Jerry Jones fan, you are a Dallas Cowboy fan. Because there's no other Jerry Jones fans out there. But Jerry Jones talking about the good old days.
I think that's a part of leadership, is to have some of the guys that have gone before that have been disappointed to share it with everybody involved. For me, it's a reminder. I, too, have been here 23 years. And it is a reminder. I've been here when it was glory hole days, and I've been here when it wasn't. And so having said that, I want me some glory hole. So I have that perspective.
Jerry Jones, he won't stop, will he? He won't stop. I always love the reaction of people who hear it for the first time, and both Brandon Droz and Adriana had not heard that clip, and they both had the same reaction. They both kind of went eyes up, like, what did he just say? Jerry Jones fighting with Roger Goodell, and he won't let it go. He will not back down. He continues to say he's going to sue the NFL. And it reminds me about hated sports figures, people you love to root against. Jerry Jones is somebody I like to root against. And when he's walking around and he's saying things like,
I want me some glory hole.
He's easy to root against. So you tell me, who in sports do you like to root against at 503-417-7575? And I'll tell you what Jerry Jones is saying. He won't back down. He's going after Roger Goodell. I'll tell you more about it next. Against in sports. 503-417-7575 is the phone number. I find Cam Newton easy to root against. And it's just because every time Cam Newton does something great, what does he do? He comes back and he says something stupid. He's easy to root against. Cam Newton, you know.
Does this offense, and I know you had several at Detroit, New England, do you think you guys have the wherewithal to do that consistently week in and week out?
Next question.
Thank you.
There he is. He walks out for the news conference. Cam Newton, easy to root against. You know who else is easy to root against? Johnny Manziel. He's one of these guys where, like, we love a comeback story, right? But we also look at Johnny Manziel and we go, I don't think so.
GMs or coaches have reached out to me. They've reached out to my agents, a little bit of both. My agent will go out and reach out to other people as well. And as far as like looking at a CFL route, it's definitely something that I've looked into. If I wouldn't have had as much interest as I've had this year as talking with some teams and seeing how things have played out, you know, I probably would have taken that route. Because at the same time, you know, I don't want to be out of football too long without playing. It's not fun to sit around kind of on a Saturday and a Sunday as you've been playing those days for the past 6 years of your life. So at the same time, you know, There's only so much time I can sit around and watch college football.
How about this? He's easy to root against. Nobody wants Johnny Manziel to come back. Everybody's like, if he doesn't make it back, he's had his time. Nobody wants Cam Newton to win a championship unless you're a Panthers fan. You go, he's had his time. How about Jay Cutler? Easy to root against Jay Cutler.
Cutler in the gun from the Raider 15. It's the shotgun snap. Looks right. Throws towards the end zone. Caught by Julius Thomas for the touchdown. Thomas started to the right. Curled towards the middle of the end zone. Cutler fires a strike.
Cutler. Ugh.
Well, the good thing is I play quarterback, so I don't really have to be in that great of cardiovascular shape. But I'll be fine. Adam knows... kind of what I've been up to, so we'll figure it out along the way.
It doesn't matter. I'm just a quarterback. I don't need to be in shape. Jay Cutler, easy to root against. The Warriors, I find the Warriors now are easier to root against. I grew up a Warriors fan, but the Warriors, to me, it's just too much. It's too much of this whole Warriors thing.
Drifting outside, chest pass, got it to Crawford as McCall went for a steal. Pass batted down by Caspi. Caspi on the break, Jones back, handoff play, Thompson dunks it with a right hand. Minnesota's going to call another timeout with 7:41 to go. And the Warriors have tied their largest lead of the night. It's 105-84.
Warriors, easier to root against than ever before. How about this guy? A guy that I don't like, even though I rooted for his team. How about Barry Bonds? People rooting for him to get in the Hall of Fame? Nope.
I'll give you a player. You give me a little one-liner. Giancarlo Stanton.
Monster.
Mike Trout.
Stud.
Bryce Harper.
Wow. Wow. That boy is going to be real good. Real good. Those three are real good. But Bryce Harper, wow. Wow.
Am I going to see you in Cooperstown?
Sure. Sure. I even get a car for both of us.
There we go.
Barry Bonds getting the Hall of Fame or not. By the way, Harper's also on the list of the most hated athletes. The 25 most hated athletes of all time. LeBron is easy to root against because he's had success as well. And I think that's one of the markers when you talk about rooting against athletes or rooting against players. One of the markers is always success. Like the Yankees and the Cowboys are disliked because the Yankees and Cowboys, they won.
And LeBron James and Neil Keenan, that's what the crowd was waiting for.
Oh, Cannon going to Malcolm. It is Cannon. You knew he was going to mouth off at some point. Cannon, here we go.
Cannon started the whole game.
Yeah. It's like LeBron, and by the way, Enos Kanter.
Coming to my house, playing that water bottle flip game again. You know what I mean? I don't care who you are, king. What do you call yourself? King, queen, princess, whatever you are. You know what? We're gonna fight, and nobody out there gonna punk us. I mean, come on, you can't just mess with the rookie like that. You know, if you're gonna mess with, go mess with the grown man. You know what I mean? And I'll die for my teammates.
I come away from that liking Kanter more. I don't know if that. And to me, that's a tell.
He caught what? What is it? Say it again.
You can call yourself king, queen, princess. You're not going to punk us.
Well, I'm the king. My wife is the queen and my daughter is the princess. So we got all three covered.
What happened with you and Ennis and Frank on that play there?
Nothing.
Make a dinner reservation?
Never that. Nothing. Nothing. Dude. I mean, we got the win. I'm not going to say that guy's name again. Anyways, next question, please.
LeBron moving on there. Who else is easy to root against? 503-417-7575 is the number. I want you to give me the athlete that you find it very easy to root against. For me, it's the guys that I've mentioned, plus this guy right here. I know that he's got a good head of hair. I know that he's a really good player. Those are not the reasons why I don't like Tom Brady. I don't like Tom Brady because I think he cheated with the Patriots.
Yeah, you know, I try to help people along with, the things that I do that help me feel really good. And I do really love the game, and I love practicing and playing, and I love being with my teammates and working hard. So it is fun for me, and, I plan on doing it for a long time.
Yeah, you've had your fun, Tom Brady. There's categories for me. It's guys that have, there are guys that have ethically, that you don't buy. Like Johnny Manziel, I look at him and I go, okay, there's a guy who's had a problem, it looks like, with alcohol. And then you got guys like Greg Hardy with the Cowboys. And I go, okay, there's a guy who you don't think is a good person away from the field. So there's the ethical guys. Then there's the you've had your fun crowd. And it's really where the Dallas Cowboys and the Yankees fall into. And Tom Brady. And to some extent, Duck fans, you can relate to this. Because it wasn't like Chip Kelly's personality changed when he was the Ducks coach. It wasn't like you changed at all as a program. You still had the same history. But when you won for an extended period of time, people suddenly didn't like you. And it was, you've had your fun. Seahawks fans, you've had your fun. It's kind of the Seahawks thing. Bill Belichick, is he somebody that you root against? You find it easy to root against? Who do you find it easy to root against? Gliss, you're down there producing the show. Who is it? Give me like your top couple people you find really easy to root against.
I'm instantly thinking NBA. Draymond Green definitely comes to mind. Rajon Rondo.
Rondo. Ugh.
He just seems like a jerk. I don't know what it is about him. But also James Harden. Not a fan of James Harden.
What? Okay, is it more Harden's game that gets you? Yeah.
Yeah, for Harden, it's his game. It's just he acts like he got shot in the calf every time he goes down the lane, and I just don't like watching him play.
Every time I see him play, I go, hell of a soccer player. You know what I mean? Because he's got that down.
It's true.
Hell of a soccer player, that guy. 503-417-7575. For different reasons. See, Rondo, you think about Rondo, he's just had problems with people. Remember when he was talking about his Instagram post?
I said what I said. You know, people can take it how they want to. I made a statement. You know, I wasn't angry. It wasn't a rant. It's just my thoughts.
And not a great teammate, this guy. Draymond Green, he's a jerk to play against. You wouldn't, no fun. If he's your guy and you're in a pickup game and he's on your side, you love him. If he's on the other team, you want to kill him. Jeff's in Eugene. Let's go out to Jeff. Jeff, who do you love to root against?
Vontaze Burfict. Not a big fan.
Do you think he's he intends to be dirty or he just has no self-control?
I mean, maybe some low IQ, and I think he intends to be dirty. Been watching him for years.
Yeah, at Arizona State, he had the same problems.
Yeah.
Same problems. Now, I always wonder if he's got a little bit of... See, because there's two different things when you see guys who can't control themselves. Like, you look at Rasheed Wallace. Rasheed, it was emotion. He just couldn't, he couldn't bottle that up, and sometimes that was... And I don't know if it's emotional maturity or what it is, but it was just pure emotion. Where he would get a technical foul, he would hurt the team, and you'd go, Rasheed, come on. But Burfict, he has that combined with the idea that, he's hitting you dirty, he's hitting you after the play. Kurt Warner talking about getting hit by Burfict.
There's just no place in the game for that, especially no place in the game for that now with so many of the issues that we're dealing with and that we're fighting against, and we're trying to clean up the game and protect the game so it can have longevity.
Ramon Foster in Pittsburgh talking about Vontaze Burfict a couple of years ago.
One or two times, okay, I get it, but every single time, a stake has to be driven into the ground on this guy, and I'm not sure what they care about, touchdown celebrations or player safety, but something has to be done.
Who do you like to dislike? Let's go to Jay in Longview. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, two guys. One's a coach. It's Nick Saban with Alabama. Always love to root against Alabama. That makes it fun on Saturday. And also from the NFL, I can't stand Phillip Rivers, so love to hate on him.
Yeah, look, you're going to get polarizing opinions on Saban because some people love Nick Saban. I don't like him because he comes off bully-like. All right, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast of this show on SoundCloud, iTunes. Just search for the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. It is free. Few things in life are free, but this is one of them. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time. Leave it right here. Great programming ahead of you right here in Portland on 102.9 The Game.